Now, I'm not sure I actually remember the last time I was in here recording with you. Was it? Yeah, it was probably something with Romans, right? So we're talking months ago.
Yeah, sometime in mid-spring, late spring.
Late spring. Yeah, I think last year we did a series on books we read over the summer. So I'm assuming you read a lot of books.
Right.
I read a lot of books.
Didn't do that this year.
Not this year. I did less than I would have liked to this year for various reasons. Mm. But we're not here to talk about that today, though. Mm-hmm. We're here to talk about Exodus, which is starting I'm not sure when everyone is going to be listening to this right off. It's probably this coming Sunday that we're going to be starting Exodus. But it's not the first time we're starting Exodus. It's actually part two of a series we did last fall. So today, Mike and I are going to give you a little recap. So we ended with Song of the Sea, Exodus 15. So you want to start there, or do you want to work our way from the beginning all the way up until that point?
Well, it's maybe helpful to paint the picture where we leave and then to flash back to see what gets you there. I mean, the Song of the Sea, you have a people who've reached the edge of the water. They're no longer being pursued. They have an open way ahead of them. And Moses breaks out into songs about God's deliverance.
As one does.
It makes for a great musical, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're told there that the people believed God and trusted his servant Moses. So this is a sweet time. It's a time of satisfaction. It's a time where they've survived. They've been kept. And it is a pause point, naturally, in the narrative of Exodus. There are things that have already been put into the story that we're going to see pick up as we turn back to the narrative and its furtherance this fall.
Yeah.
But this would be the natural intermission. You know, if you're going to take a break mid movie,
yeah,
this is sort of the spot.
It's a happy ending, sort of. I mean, we've closed one loop. I'm thinking if we go all the way back to chapter one briefly, and we talk about the Israelites are oppressed, which was not what was promised to Father Abraham back in Genesis 12. It was promised, you know, land, descendants, blessing. There's a lot of descendants, but there's no land and there's no blessing. And so we've moved away from the oppression towards blessing. We're not quite there yet, but we definitely haven't solved the land issue.
Yeah, lots of descendants. It's not just the promise to Abraham in Genesis 12 either. At the end of Genesis, the people get to Egypt as a way of surviving a famine, and they're welcomed back by Joseph, the right-hand man to the Pharaoh. And so at the beginning of Exodus, several centuries have passed. The people have grown much more numerous. They have not grown much more prosperous. Mm. In fact, we learn there's a Pharaoh who doesn't remember Joseph, which clearly means he doesn't take the same perspective.
Sure.
Doesn't show the same favor.
It's one of those very ominous verses at the opening
right.
of the story.
And so Exodus 1 starts in this brutal spot. Surprisingly, they're now slaves. And not only are they slaves, but repeatedly there in the language of Exodus 1, it insists on describing the toilsome toil with which they toil.
Mm.
It describes just redundantly and powerfully the oppressive, death-dealing nature of their circumstance as they wallow in this slavery under Pharaoh in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, that even ties us even farther back into Genesis. We think about Genesis 3 and the curse, and by the sweat of your brow, and the difficulty that's going to come with work is even heightened in this sense, too, at the beginning of Exodus.
Yeah, and not just the pain of work, but also the other curse there that birth is going to bring pain. We very quickly in the story realize that Pharaoh, threatened by them, is going to unleash this campaign of genocide.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this story of a baby being redeemed or delivered from certain death by being placed in the Nile River, by being rescued by women serving in Pharaoh's own house, being raised by Pharaoh's own daughter. It's this remarkable story of divine provision and providence on the one hand. On the other hand, it's over and against this horrific situation where not only is work encumbered by toil and curse, but also childbirth Hebrew women can't have babies, but that there's going to be the threat of bloodshed.
Yeah. And it even sets up, it's not the same Pharaoh at that point later, but it allows for a connection between the two because he's just called Pharaoh. So he can be this figurehead of power that is set up over and against Yahweh that is intending to oppress the people of God rather than liberate them.
Yeah. Yeah. And in a similar way to what we saw in Genesis, this problem, this growing problem, is addressed in a very surprising way. In Exodus 3, we see that God's deliverance comes in a strange form. The previous chapter, Exodus 2, we hear that God has heard the cries of the Israelites. He has seen their pain. He has come down. He remembers his covenant promises. And the immediate story is he goes out, as it's described, to the wilderness where there's a guy who's basically committed manslaughter.
Fugitive.
This Moses character, fugitive from the law, because in seeking to protect one of his own from an Egyptian slave master, he killed the Egyptian slave master and fled. And God goes and appears in the famous burning bush to Moses, calling him to be his spokesman. It's as unlikely as God taking a random character from Ur named Abram and suggesting that this is going to be the one through whom the global problem of sin is going to be addressed. God showing he can work through the most surprising of characters.
Yeah. And it even heightens it even more as we talked about the fugitive nature of Moses, where Abraham's kind of a nondescript. We don't really know much about him. He just kind of is a nobody. And Moses, it's like, well, he could have been a somebody, and then he became a nobody because he had to run away because of the incident you describe. And so it seems like his story is basically a dead end at the point where God finds him in Exodus 3.
At that point, surely Pharaoh's house views him negatively. He ate their food. He learned their lessons. Then he killed their guy and fled off. He's no more well received by his own, though, surely. I mean, the Israelites would have to view him as someone who, though he's one of them, he was raised in Pharaoh's house.
Right. None of the toilsome toil.
Right. It's far grander than even sort of the house slave character back in the day. He got to live in the palace and not as a slave, as an adopted child, as it were. And then he kills someone, he runs off, and surely they're left dealing with the anger and the vengeance of the Egyptians while Moses is long gone. So Moses is a character at this point who surely has no one in his corner other than this God who shows up appearing, speaking from the burning bush.
Yeah. And I think we talked about this in one of our previous episodes. Like, he's not even really interested in that. There's this constant back and forth arguing with God, like, well, I'm not a good public speaker. They're not going to believe me. You know, just God keeps conceding things to him in the course of the conversation. But it's clear that Moses really doesn't want this opportunity that's been presented.
Yeah, that's right. He's hesitant in all sorts of ways. And we see coming out of the conversation, he shows resolve and he steps right up and addresses Pharaoh, which is a remarkable turn or conversion. And it's fascinating to see God responds to many questions, objections, we might say. The crucial thing that really makes Moses a new man, that converts him from being feeble, from being fearful in point of fact, to actually being emboldened and courageous, is he learns the lordship of Yahweh. God reveals, you know, I am who I am. I'm the God of, who's the God of the fathers of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's my name henceforth, and that's my name forevermore. It's in knowing that he is Lord on high, that he's a God greater than Pharaoh or any of the gods of Egypt, that Moses is emboldened. And what we see from that point on is that theme of the lordship of Yahweh is really going to be this thread that runs through the remainder of Exodus, that's going to be the great theme. The wonderful Jewish scholar John Levinson points out the main theme of the text is not Jewish slaves get free. That's the means to a greater theme, which is Yahweh is shown to be enthroned, not Pharaoh. It's truly about understanding who the right Lord is.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're going to see more of this fall as we get into really the other two-thirds of the book. I mean, in some sense, it's Exodus 1 through 15, like we talked about. It kind of stands alone. I mean, we stopped at a climactic end portion where the slaves were freed, but then there's 25 more chapters to go of the rest of the book telling more of the story. This is almost like a prologue to that more central theme of the book of Exodus, even though it's not the stories that stick out in our mind as clearly.
Yeah. And there's maybe two themes that we saw from the burning bush to the end of chapter 15 that will set us up for what's to come this fall as we journey through the rest of the book. The first is, because this is revealing God to be the true Lord, the demand that Moses is sent repeatedly to deliver to Pharaoh on God's behalf is not simply let my people go. It's let my people go so that they might serve me or worship me at my mountain.
Mm.
And it's never about autonomy. It's never about just being loosed free to do whatever you wish. It's always about transference from one kingdom to another, from the death-dealing service of Pharaoh to the life-giving service of Yahweh. And that's represented by meeting God at his mountain. And so we're going to see early in our focus this fall, they quickly get to Sinai, to the mountain of God, and you camp there, where we learn what God teaches on his mountain about what new life in that life-giving kingdom of Yahweh the Lord is like. That's the first theme that we're already set up for. The second theme that we see in the interaction between Moses and Pharaoh in what we call the plague cycle is the importance of the power of God. You know, it's not for nothing that there's this somewhat onerous, almost tiresome, and strange cycle of these 10 different episodes. God doesn't just come in and offer a quick kill shot. He doesn't go straight for the jugular. But there's this very patient, persistent practice of doing something mighty, and then of seeing how Pharaoh and the Egyptians respond before having to do so again. And it's only with the 10th and final plague, killing the beloved sons of Egypt, that finally Pharaoh relents truly and completely. And what we see here, we saw this in detail last sermon series on the plagues, was that the gods of Egypt are being mocked. Each of those plagues illustrate how the gods of Egypt are powerless in the face of Yahweh. And that theme of divine power is going to be crucial for understanding the rest of the book, I think.
Yeah, and it's also maybe helpful to think, too, that he's showing his power as a means of giving Egypt an opportunity to respond. Because, like you said, he didn't just start with the kill shot. It wasn't really efficient to go about things the way God goes about things in Exodus, in this long, drawn-out back and forth. But he's systematically showing the inferiority of their gods so that they might choose to worship him. And a lot of Egyptians do, as we read in Exodus 12, there was the mixed multitude of, I mean, if you were Joe Egyptian in that place at that time, and you witnessed all of these things, and you might think to yourself, well, they told me that, you know, all of our gods can do X, Y, and Z, but their God just actually did it, and I saw it, and it would be a fairly compelling picture. I mean, we can only use our imagination to some extent of what it would have been like, but to see the power of God displayed in Egypt, it was for a purpose. It was for drawing the people to himself, not merely showing this. He's not flexing just to flex, as we might say.
And not only that, but even in those final chapters, you mentioned chapter 12, as we carry through all the way to 15, God doesn't just do these plagues, these wonders, so as to free them from Egypt, but then he powerfully guides and protects and provides. And so you've got the pillar of fire, you've got the cloud, you've got the hedge of protection against chariots when they come after you after Pharaoh's had a rethink and a day of regret. And when he tries to reclaim his former slaves, Yahweh steps in and most famously, of course, opens up the sea. And so you do have this sequence of this slow, somewhat inefficient, but persistently growing set of demonstrations of divine power. And then God's continued steadfastness in employing his power to provide. It's a great reminder that it's not as though resurrection power is just there for conversion or the beginning of life with God, but it's also manifest in manna for the day, in protection for the pilgrimage, in guidance for the journey. And we see that already just in those last two or three chapters we looked at.
Yeah, we had glimmers of it right before we got to where we ended last Christmas. And then so we're going to... I'll do two things. We'll get to the preview of where we're going in a minute. But you said there was two themes. So there was this theme of his power, and then what's the other theme that we really need to keep in the back of our mind?
Well, and just this earlier idea I'd mentioned of the main focus of the text not so much being the position of the people, but the lordship of their God, and that's manifest in that. The original design was always not just that they get out of Egypt, but that they go serve God at his mountain. And one of the radical reversals in the story here is the way in which the same language, the same words in Hebrew that are used in chapter 1 to describe toilsome service to Pharaoh are the very same words that get repeatedly used to describe God's purpose, that they would serve or worship God at his mountain. And so what we're going to see is really something that Paul in Romans 6 will describe as being transferred from slavery to sin and being transferred into slavery to righteousness, that we're not meant to be on our own, to be our own gods or lords, and we're certainly not meant to be independent in the most ultimate sense. But we are meant to be called out of the fallen kingdoms of this world and the death-dealing ways of the powers and the principalities and the Pharaoh, and to be called into the kingdom of God's beloved Son. And that's what we're going to see. What does it mean now, not simply to be called away from slavery to Pharaoh, but to be called to and constituted as a people in this kingdom?
Yeah, and I like how you connect it there with Paul in Romans, because the whole story, not just the first part of slaves in Egypt, cross the Red Sea, the end, but the parts that we're getting to in this fall series, it really does help illustrate in a narrative sense the things that Paul talks about in Romans and elsewhere in the New Testament of this transfer of authority, this moving from one kingdom to the other. We get a very visceral story that showcases that, and then we get a theological description of it in the New Testament, and they really are meant to go hand in hand and not, oh, that's just a fun story, or oh, that's interesting that God worked that way and that way in that place at that time, but he does things different now.
Yeah, and you know, we'll see in a variety of ways the extent of God's concern, where the radical way in which he wants to be Lord of all involves him describing our personal life, our public life, what we would describe as our religious or worshipful life, as well as our economic and our family and our household life. We'll see in this second half plus, this little over 50% of Exodus that we'll be cruising through in these months, that the range of concerns is as global as could be imagined in terms of all of life being a concern of God. And precisely because these are people who've spent centuries, which means the entire lifetime of those there at that point, in Egypt, they've been malformed and they've been misinformed, and they've got to be not just converted, but discipled.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a great model and example for understanding not just Christian conversion, but discipleship as well, and how that's meant to be intergenerational, and how that occurs over and against really nasty, very anti-Christian, or in this case, anti-Israelite, religious settings.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because we're going to be, people probably don't realize this at the on the outside, but we're really stopping at Mount Sinai for the next year and a half, give or take. I mean, I say that because the intention is we've been moving through the Pentateuch and we're finishing Exodus this fall, but all of Leviticus that we'll probably cover next fall also takes place at the foot of Mount Sinai. The Israelites have not moved on from there. The story sort of moves forward, but the need to really instruct and inform and reform them takes a long time. It's a very central piece of the Pentateuch is just hanging out at Mount Sinai. It's not going here and there. And we think about the wilderness wanderings, but it's going to be a while before we get to those, although we will get to them.
Yeah. And I mean, you can even appreciate perhaps why that's got to be the case if you think of just the most famous or infamous parts, the bits of Leviticus people know, right? On the one hand, we know there's lots about sacrifices, especially blood sacrifices, things like the Day of Atonement. So there's an understanding of spirituality and sacrifice and what we think is liturgy and worship. On the other hand, if we know anything in the modern world, it's that Leviticus talks about things like the sanctity of our sex lives and the way in which we behave sexually, how that is meant to be ordered by God. The fact that that text has to range in such patient care and detail over everything from how you worship to how you employ your body and your sex life, it really illustrates this idea that it's not as though they had one small slice of life wrong. Mm. And if only they could find a hack or a fix or an update, they'd be okay. But rather, the catch with fallenness and malformation is it tends to permeate and to impact the total picture. And God is involved in just complete transformation. In the same way we later learn Christ is making all things new, here God is constituting a people altogether new.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not as if we think about the giving of the law, it's not as if it covers every topic imaginable, but it's that it doesn't leave any part of life untouched. This is my religious life, and this is you know, God's not concerned with this facet of my existence. It's a comprehensive way of life.
Yeah, and that's why in the prophets of the later Old Testament or in Jesus himself in the gospel accounts, so often, in fact, I'd almost say virtually every time they are quoting from the Old Testament, it's fascinating to see that they're challenging people not for not doing part of the law, but for not having integrity, for taking a part of it and cutting off other elements, for failing to catch its extent, its fullness, its complete range of concern. And so I take from that's a universal human problem. That's a persistent human temptation. And we're likely not more free of that than folks in Jesus's day, folks in the prophet's day, folks in these Israelites' day.
Yeah.
We've been malformed by other cultural currents. We've been misinformed by other educational realities. But we, too, need to be taken to school to learn how does, you know, all of Jesus relate to all of life? And how can we be reconstituted such that we're mindful and committed to that in every area of our lives?
Yeah. Well, so I think we'll see some of that this fall. I mean, we're not going to get all of the law this fall, but just to kind of look ahead a little bit, we said we ended with Song of the Sea. So I'll give just a big picture overview of it, and then we can maybe have some closing comments. But we'll pick up in 16. That's where they get the manna from heaven. They get the pillar of fire and the cloud that they follow. And so we have all this kind of set up to get to Sinai. We get to Sinai, I think, in 19. And then we'll do a deep dive here a little bit later on the Ten Commandments. So the giving of the law on Exodus 20. Then we get some miscellaneous laws, which we'll talk about that a little bit in our Ten Commandments podcast. But we might do a separate series on what's going on with those. Because it feels like we get 10 really definitive things. And then we get 3 chapters of what to do if your ox gores people to death. And how to deal with other things like that. That we're like, oh, I don't know that concerns me, but then somehow, you know, Paul thinks it does because he draws on some of those passages later. At that point, we get the instructions for the building of the tabernacle, and then we get the actual building of the tabernacle. But in between those two things, we have this famous golden calf incident where Moses is up on the mountain for too long. the Israelites are concerned he may never come back. And so Aaron melts some stuff down, and then lo and behold, this calf pops out, and he doesn't know how it happened, as he recounts later, and the people are worshiping. And so we'll do a separate podcast on that as well, to kind of give some background and how that connects. And then the book ends with this sort of climactic, the tabernacle gets put together and God's presence comes in and dwells in that. And then it ends the book of Exodus, but it's really just set up for, okay, well, now that this holy God is living with this people, what must they do to maintain his presence?
Yeah, and one thing that by the end we'll see with some clarity, increasing clarity, I think, is that obviously it's a text that's going to focus at key points for chapters on end on offering law and instruction. But we learn that it's not enough simply to have the right law or instruction, the right rules or guidance. There's another factor, the user, and there's always the possibility of user error. And so we're going to see from chapter 19 on, all the way through the Golden Calf episode in 32 to 34, that the character of Israel matters greatly. Hmm. And we're going to see that that's a problem when you're dealing with sinners who are not going to simply and straightforwardly obey the law or follow the direction. And therefore, seeds are going to start to be planted of how we need something more than merely law stated. We need eventually law fulfilled. Mm-hmm. We need ultimately God's presence, not merely the presence of clarity and of direction, but of divine power personified in our midst. And you don't, of course, get big bright lights screaming the word Jesus in the book of Exodus, but you get all these small hints and suggestions that start to grow and snowball over the course of Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and latter portions of the Old Testament. And as you mentioned, later New Testament authors like Paul, they pick them up and they point out this is what Christ has come to fulfill. And they do that because Jesus himself speaks in that way, saying that what he comes to be and to do, not just to teach, but to be and to do on our behalf as Savior, is to go back to things that were already becoming evident in this time.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll start to see with growing significance and importance that great need for divine presence and the power that only God can give.
Yeah. Well, I think that illustrates a tension. I think we'll all maybe sit in a little bit as we go through this Exodus series. And we may have been in it earlier in other Old Testament series of, we really want to read these texts and hear these texts as if we don't already know how the story ends. Like when we were just talking about Moses, and it's like, it really is remarkable if you read the early part of Exodus and the latter part, and you think, like, if you don't know about the latter part, Moses does not seem like the kind of guy who's going to lead Israel out of Egypt. And yet you can appreciate the transformation that you see if you're not thinking of the Moses that you already have in your head. But at the same time, you bring up a good point of we are wanting to think about Exodus in light of the New Testament. Mm-hmm. Like, where's this story going? So we're trying to sit in the story with where we are in the story, but also sort of looking ahead, but trying to see, I don't want to say with fresh eyes, because I feel like that's kind of cliche, but there's a sense in which maybe we can go through this series this fall as if we haven't heard the Ten Commandments before. We don't already know what the Golden Calf incident is right around the corner. It's not, you can kind of see it coming, you can kind of not see it coming in some ways.
Right. Yeah, there's value to reading forwards and backwards, isn't there? And to keep trying each in different ways.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I appreciate taking time to do a little recap and get people up to speed before we jump into this series. I do like that we hit an Old Testament book every fall. But when we do, when we break one in half like this, it's like, well, we could kind of lose the thread. I mean, Christmas was a while ago. Like, I mean, 9 months is a while, but, you know, to kind of think back to all the things we talked about last fall. So I hope this helps bring it into fresh perspective for people as we now jump right into the middle of the story in Exodus 16 next week.
Excellent. Look forward to it.